This is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday, the 22nd day of March, 2011. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Iti Agnihotri Mutholkar.
Later on this edition of Ozarks at Large, how to pay for roads and highways in Arkansas's future. Roby Brock from TalkBusiness.net sits down with Speaker of the House Robert Moore to talk about his highway funding package. But first,
just north of Fayetteville's new Westside Water Waste Treatment Plant is a very special meadow, which a crew of Cherokee burned last Friday. Jacqueline Froelich takes us there to explain.
The weather conditions today are perfect for an intentional prairie fire, a bit of breeze, slightly humid and balmy. A so-called prescribed or controlled burn of 50 acres will occur here in a few hours, as soon as the crew's all set. We're standing on the edge of Woolsey Wet Prairie, a constructed wetland, named after the family who first settled this place in the 1840s. For decades, this place was a cow pasture planted in Bermuda grass, native plants that once thrived in and around shallow pools and ponds in this former wet meadow disappeared. So did the wildlife that fed on it. But when the city undertook construction of a new wastewater treatment plant, it traded ecological mitigation credit by restoring this place back to its original state. The city hired Bruce Shackelford, president of environmental consulting operations based in Benton, Arkansas. This is one of his pet projects.
Today we're going to do a prescribed burn. This will be the fourth prescribed burn that we've done. And it's especially going to be a history-making prescribed burn because our burn contractor is Shaleda Fire LLC. They are a 100% Native American-owned and operated company based in Oklahoma City. And so it's really interesting because history tells us that Native Americans frequently burned, and that's why we had prairies up here.
Spelled S-H-L-O-E-T-A and pronounced Shaleda. The word represents a small Cherokee community in northeastern Oklahoma. Shaleda employs 35 people, more than half of which are tribal members.
So what's so exciting about Shaleda and looking at the history of Native Americans burning in northwest Arkansas, the Chickamauga Cherokee, they were actually given a federal treaty up here from 1817 until 1825. And so they probably did prescribe burns. If they didn't, the Osage certainly did before they did. And so this means that it's probably the first time that Native Americans, now that we have Shaleda coming to the site, have burned Woolsey Wet Prairie in probably over 200 years. So we're very excited about it.
Bruce Shackelford says prescribed burns are good for the land.
Oh, it definitely increases the plant diversity. It removes the thatch layer of all the dying plant material that's died over the winter, and you get this thatch and organic layer built up. And many of the prairie seeds, they actually need sunlight to germinate. And so it's kind of like peeling back the layers, and there can actually be seeds that have been dormant in the seed bed that will come back if you do that adaptive management.
To restore the original drenched nature, Shackelford built a series of meandering clay berms and sluices that flow in and hold surface water. When he started, he could only count 40 plant species.
The status of the site right now, we're up to 379 species of plants without seeding anything. And as a reminder, we started out with 47 plant species, many of which were invasive. And so using adaptive management techniques, we've increased the plant community. And a really exciting thing that has happened only last week, Mike Mladenow, one of the birders in northwest Arkansas, he saw a northern shrike. And Joe Neal actually took pictures of it. You can see those pictures of the northern shrike on the Woolsey Wet Prairie website. Go to Eco Arkansas and click on Woolsey, Maine. And so this is the second known record of the northern shrike to be seen in Arkansas.
And shrike are coming here because this is one of the last remnants of America's rare wet prairies. Over the past 6 years, Shackelford has used selective herbicides and burns to restore this place. He and a group of volunteers have also planted hundreds of pecan, black walnut, and persimmon trees as savanna cover. Summers, visitors can see native plant species, including big and little blue stem, switchgrass, Indian grass, and gay feather. 2 centuries ago, bison and eastern elk likely walked around here, as did native prairie chickens. Today, Woolsey Prairie is again a wildlife destination.
Oh, absolutely. We have a lot of animal life out here. The birders are out here all the time. And I frequently get emails or seeing all kinds of really cool birds. I was out here one time last winter, and I saw a mink out here. And, of course, we know there are coyotes, there are deer, there are raccoons. Some of the adaptive management we're going to do, it's kind of overgrown a little bit because of the drought last year. And so we're going to burn off some of this vegetation and try to open up some more mud flats, and that'll bring back a lot of the shorebirds that we had. And so I think there's been like 17 species of shorebirds observed out here at Woolsey Wet Prairie. So we're trying to tweak the habitat a little bit so we have more shorebirds.
As you can hear, songbirds have returned along with the water birds. In 2009, the city of Fayetteville, for its effort here, was the recipient of a Governor's 2009 Corporate Conservationist of the Year Award, given by Arkansas Wildlife Federation.
OMI must give them credit. Tim Luther, operations manager with OMI, we found out here recently, he applied to the National Wildlife Federation and successfully got Woolsey Wet Prairie certified as a national wildlife habitat. And so there will be signs put up that designate that certification. So that's just another feather in the cap of the city of Fayetteville.
Describe what you're wearing.
Oh, what I'm wearing?
Yes, you're so bright. You're hurting my eyes.
Well, right now I kind of look like a canary boy scout because I have on these green pants, and I have on a bright yellow canary shirt, and it's a material commonly known as Nomex. It's a fire-resistant material, and it's some of the PPE or protective personal equipment that firefighters or prescribed burn crews wear because it is fire-resistant. As we speak, here comes some of the Shaleda trucks.
The burn crew.
And so you don't want to wear any type of synthetics like nylon or rayon, anything like that, that if it gets exposed to a flame, it's going to melt. It's only going to cause an injury. So it's part of the equipment that you'll see the burn crew have out here today. They'll probably be wearing some yellow shirts, too.
My name is Chad McCaffrey. I'm with Shaleda Fire. We do around 20 burns a year. All over Arkansas and Oklahoma Bowl.
Okay, what we have here, which Shaleda has brought, and I actually put together specifications for the informal bid process so that all the burn contractors bidding on it knew the required equipment. And we wanted everything to come off safely. This is sort of an urban interface burn. We want them to have a pump truck with adequate water. And what you see here on the back of this truck, those are drip torches. And that's how they will start the fire, and they'll get a drip torch going, and usually it has a mixture of about 30% gasoline and two-thirds diesel fuel. So it's not extremely volatile, but it's enough to walk around and you'll drip that burning fuel out of that drip torch and start the fire line.
Took time for the burn crew to set up the perimeter and conduct the burn, but according to an email sent yesterday, Bruce Shackelford reported it was very successful. A northern backfire burned well into the site as the crew set a series of flank and strip fires. Finally, a head fire was set on the south end. The burn crew waded through flooded areas with their drip torches to ignite small islands that had formed probably several thousand years ago as prairie mounds. And by 1 o'clock in the afternoon, it was done. Bruce Shackelford said small rodents could be seen scurrying across blackened openings as hawks swooped down through the clouds of smoke giving chase. And the day after the burn, wildlife biologist Joe Neal hiked Woolsey Wet Prairie and reported seeing numerous migrating American bitterns, song swamp, and savanna sparrows feeding on seeds in the blackened areas, blue and green-winged teal, and 15 to 20 Wilson's snipe. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Visitors are welcome at Woolsey Wet Prairie, and tours can be arranged by contacting Operations Management International at 443-3292. You can also visit the site online at ecoarkansas.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. A measure to require people getting unemployment benefits to test negative for certain drugs has failed in a legislative committee. The measure would require random testing of recipients for the presence of cocaine, heroin, or methamphetamines. The sponsor of the bill, State Senator Bill Pritchard, says it would have saved the state money.
It would lower the amount of unemployment being paid out to people who are not ready for work. And if you're on methamphetamine, cocaine, or heroin, you're obviously not ready for work. And then it would hopefully encourage those people, so that they can't draw unemployment benefits, to seek help. And we had a mechanism in there to refer them to some treatment programs.
Opponents said the testing could constitute an illegal search of a person's body. Others said it would hurt the innocent families of unemployed workers using drugs. The bill failed on a voice vote. This is Ozarks at Large.
The month of March is celebrated as Women's History Month in the United States. On its 24th anniversary, the celebration is centered on the theme, Our History is Our Strength. Nationally, the women of Arkansas rank among the lowest on key status indicators such as political participation, employment and earnings, reproductive rights, and health and well-being, etc. The lack of an umbrella organization representing women and their interests on a state level has been felt since the 1990s, when the last Women's Commission was dissolved. I spoke with University of Arkansas political science professor Dr. Janine Perry to discuss the history of commissions for women in Arkansas and their successes and failures. Dr. Perry is the director of Arkansas Poll and chaired an advisory committee to the DC-based Institute for Women's Policy Research that put out a series of state reports on the status of women in 2000 to 2004. If we talk about the state of women in Arkansas, where are we right now?
Well, what we know mostly from census data and the current population survey and other similar data sets that are done nationwide, such that we can compare Arkansas to other states. And then also we know it from the really savvy use of data such as that by organizations like the DC-based Institute for Women's Policy Research. What we know is that women in Arkansas, not unlike men in Arkansas, on most measurements of health and well-being, you know, be it economically, be it related directly to physical health or political status, tend to be toward the lower end. So on various measures, we're lucky if we break the 30s out of 50 states, but we very often find ourselves 46, 47, 48, et cetera.
But are we taking any measures to do something about that?
The answer is both yes and no. I think in terms of an affirmative response, mm-hmm. anything that we can do in Arkansas, and state legislatures have been dealing, and governors have been dealing with this for decades, even centuries, arguably, to improve educational attainment, mm-hmm. To improve the quality of the education that's delivered, to improve our economic status in the form of diversification and higher paying jobs. All of those measures are mm-hmm. going to help women as well as men. So I think we are taking some steps in that regard. On the other hand, we have had several attempts in recent years to implement more women-specific policies. And a few of these have gone forward in exciting and even front-runner ways. We have had launched some really good initiatives in terms of breast health, and we did a lot of mm-hmm. that in the 1990s, and Arkansas became a leader in that regard. And there are a few other programs along those lines. On the other hand, you know, sort of these broader programs, such as the Women's Commission mm-hmm. That recently failed and was proposed back in 2000, 2001 as well, and there was one in the 1990s, mm-hmm. and then those have had a more tenuous kind of existence, and of course we just saw one fail. So I think it narrower programs, we've had some success. Broader programs are sort of tackling the condition of women in general. I mm-hmm. think those are a hard pill to swallow for some individuals, and therefore they can be kind of a hard sell.
Now, you just mentioned that a recent bill to create a women's commission in the state of Arkansas was rejected by the House in the month of February. Why do you think the bill wasn't passed? What was the reason behind it?
I think there are some reasons that are specific to the current context in which that endeavor was tried, and then I think there are some more general reasons. And in terms of the specific context, I think there was a push in the last several months to narrow the number of boards and commissions in Arkansas, mm-hmm. and this is an initiative that we see every few years, and it's not just an Arkansas thing. It happens all over the country that someone sets up a special commission to do this, and then an agency agency to do that. And they all might have very good goals, but it can start to make government feel unwieldy and maybe less accountable. And so this was proposed right at a time when many legislators were sort of cognizant of the desire to narrow down the number of commissions. In addition to that, you know, we're in a time of an economic climate that's not particularly beneficial to a lot of individuals. It's a tough economy. And that can make any new government program, regardless of how inexpensive it might, you know, inexpensively it might be operated, that can make it a hard sell as well. And the strongest opposition, to be quite honest, often comes from women. And it's hard to tell how much attention in the newspapers was to the women or how much of the opposition, you know, actually came from women disproportionately to men. But they often are the ones who can make the strongest case against it. In my own research, I found that that's what led to a lot of very healthy and vibrant commissions in the 1960s and 70s and 80s to eventually be defeated. It was very often conservative women who were offended by what they saw as sort of liberal initiatives, and some of them were quite liberal, but not always, liberal initiatives by commissioners on these bodies, and they were often the ones who pounded the pavement hardest to have them killed, have them nullified.
Now, that is a very interesting point, because historically, even though women's commissions have been viewed as this radical organization that will, you know, fight for maybe hardcore feminist issues, they haven't been so radical after all. Even like back in the 1970s when Diane Blair created the first women's commission, she refrained from associating herself with some issues that were very radical. And even in the 1990s, the Women's Commission had more conservative members than liberals.
Yes, there are just a lot of points, I think, to be made there. But it's interesting, you know, I've studied women's commissions generally, and I've studied a number of them specifically. A very common pattern is they are often dubbed by activists as too conservative, and they are dubbed by opponents as too radical. So they're often caught, you know, in the middle. So there are many liberals, many feminists who would very much oppose the creation of a women's commission. At the same time, there are a lot of conservatives and anti-feminists who would oppose the creation of a women's commission. So that makes it a pretty tough climb in whatever context you're working.
Do you think sometimes the issues of women get lost in ethnicity?
I think that can be one of the complications. I mean, the reality is that if you treat women as a political minority, in the sense that they tend to have, you know, less institutional power, and they tend to have less, that means economic and political power both, that's one thing. But we also have to remember that that minority is very large in number, and in fact, of course, statistically a majority in most situations. That means they're all very, very different. So there are Black women and white women, there are Latinas and Asians, and sometimes those racial or ethnic concerns, you know, may trump the gender or sex-specific concerns. Tragically, of course, a lot of times all those concerns are the same, but they're compounded rather than competing. And I think that's one of the things that this idea of intersectionality that's very common in the social movement and feminist literature has really brought to the table, which is, you know, don't feel like you have to choose between advancing, you know, your Latina interests, you know, and advancing your interests as a woman, but in fact you may be disadvantaged by both, and a lot of the, you know, statistics would play that out. And it can just be really hard to figure out where is the common ground that we can hold hands and push forward, because we do know that if you look at almost any of the standard objective measurements of women's economic well-being almost anywhere in the world, it tends to be less on average than men's. But getting everybody moving in one direction, given all the things that may divide them, has proven very difficult.
But we can find a common ground, right?
I think we can, and we have. One of the more interesting debates, and it was one of the things that one of the more successful women's commissions here in Arkansas, the one that Diane Blair was chair of in the 1970s, was a really good example of, is pregnancy and pregnancy leave and maternity leave. And, you know, some of your listeners may remember the amazing debate at the national level over the 1978 Pregnancy Discrimination Act, what became the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. And there were just these amazing battles. and over it. And what's interesting is that in the end, it was conservatives, sort of social, religious, kind of evangelical conservatives and feminists ended up mm-hmm. holding hands on this issue, because the social, you know, and moral conservatives wanted to, you know, promote women's status in the home and make it possible that working women, you know, even outside the home could take some time off, you know, mm-hmm. with children, and this would advance, you know, so-called family interests and that kind of thing. But at the same time, the feminists wanted that for working women because they wanted women to continue in the workplace. So you had really, truly this great case of strange bedfellows. So every once in a while, you know, you do see groups and women inside these different groups able to hold hands and work together, but it is a real tug of war over how the issue will be defined. Mm-hmm, you know, what we call issue framing and that kind of thing. And, you know, that's why it's very unsatisfactory to many still that what they ended up doing was defining pregnancy as a disability, you know, when it's a natural function mm-hmm. and it usually goes very well and that kind of thing. But the idea was, well, it is something from which you do need some physical recovery in mm-hmm. the same way that something else that goes on with your body might require physical recovery. Mm-hmm. So that's what we were able to settle on. But boy, that idea had been around since at least the 1920s. So it took us quite a long time to get to that point.
It comes to mind, in this age of so many nonprofits that are working for women's policy research, women's issues, families, you know, the greater problems that affect women, is there even a need for a women's commission, for an umbrella organization by the state?
That's a really interesting point, and I would say that the answer probably depends on the situation. The state commissions in the 1960s originally mm-hmm. came out of the National Commission, mm-hmm. and the National Commission, you know, formed under President Kennedy, suggested to the state commissions that the national government didn't want to supersede what the states might be able to do and what they might wish to do, and so they sort of, you know, created this next level of mm-hmm. women's commissions, and so I think that was useful in the sense that they did bring together a lot of the interest groups you mentioned. So whether it was the League of Women Voters, which mm-hmm. certainly is not woman-specific, but they do have those interests at heart very often, or American Association of University Women, or often church women's groups and that kind of thing, what they found is that there aren't often always, you know, groups that are working particularly effectively on economic or health issues, or that all the groups were working on it, but this was sort of a way to bring all of their efforts, you know, under one umbrella. So I think in that sense, there's a good case to be made for there still being a place for women's commissions.
What would be an ideal women's commission?
There are a lot of different models for women's commissions. And of course, they have a lot of different names, etc. One thing that was actually tried when there was a short-lived women's commission between 1997 and 1999 in Arkansas, the founder was a state legislator, Charlotte Schechtschneider, out of Dumas. What she tried to do, knowing what had happened mm-hmm. in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, was tailor the commission's agenda to just educational and economic interests mm-hmm. and status, thinking, I think rightly, that under normal circumstances, that would be something on which people were most likely to be able to agree. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It didn't work out that way for reasons that had a lot to do with the particular climate and then also the appointment system of that period. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that works for some of the longer-lived commissions. The Michigan State Women's Commission is actually the longest-lasting one among the state commissions, mm-hmm. and all 50 mm-hmm. states at one time or another have had one. Still about half the states have them now. Michigan has, I think their appointment system mm-hmm. has been really good. Whether it's Democratic or Republicans in charge, they have managed to nominate, you know, fairly middle-of-the-road candidates. They've mm-hmm. hired an executive director who tends to be quite professional and also very well schooled in the politics of the legislature and able to sort of navigate, figure out what's doable, what's not doable. And so they sort of push forward change that is not too radical, which is, mm-hmm. again, where we get back to opponents don't like it and proponents think, you know, it's not enough. Michigan, because it has lasted so long and it's made some concrete changes, might be a model for what can work. But it's probably more the exception than the rule.
Oh, you just said Michigan was able to make some concrete changes, such as?
Well, I think if you look at the commissions that have been the most vibrant, they mm-hmm. have focused a lot on, say, women's business creation and women as business owners, mm-hmm. because that's something that it's hard to sort of for anyone to say would be a bad thing, mm-hmm. right? It's pro-economy, so therefore it must be pro-American, and therefore we shouldn't be afraid of it. And there's also been some movement in increasingly with work on sort of work-family balance. And so maybe, mm-hmm. you know, trying to find ways without a lot of government expenditure, but finding ways to at least do, you know, flex time and maybe to offer, you know, a daycare helplines, you know, for sort of connecting people or certification programs or that kind of thing to sort of help women, and by implication, many of the men in their lives, to balance all the demands on their time.
Hmm. Okay, this might be a little redundant, but working at the grassroots level, is that more effective, or does some good intention trickle down from those umbrella organizations such as women's commissions and?
It's a terrific question, and it's a question that sociologists have, you know, especially when the people who study social movements, mm-hmm. you know, is it better to be an outsider or an insider? And the scholarship that I read in graduate school and I continue to be interested in is that you really need a little bit of both. In Australia, there's a scholar who coined the term femocrats, and she was talking about, you know, people inside the bureaucracy who you would probably never identify openly as a feminist, and they mm-hmm. wouldn't identify themselves that way, but they would use their knowledge of the bureaucracy to move things in a way that might be helpful to women. And one of the classic examples, actually, it's kind of a fun story, has to do with the foundation of the National Organization for Women. Mm-hmm. There were some women working, you know, in the newly created civil rights divisions, et cetera, that came out of the civil rights acts and measures, the various ones of the 1960s. And what they found in the creation of the EEOC is that when women made complaints about their treatment on the job, they were expressly told that, well, no, really, what we're dealing with are African Americans. And those are sort of claims that we're going to enforce and pursue and investigate. And the advice from some of the women working inside the EEOC from those bureaucrats here in the United States was you need to get an equivalent for women of the NAACP. So in other words, we're on the inside, but we need you to be agitating from the outside. I think oftentimes it's just this partnership of insider and outsiders that every once in a while, you know, comes to life, mm-hmm. and that's how you move things forward.
Dr. Janine Perry is the director of Arkansas Poll and chaired an advisory committee to the D.C.-based Institute for Women's Policy Research that put out a series of state reports on the status of women in 2000 to 2004.
Nothing's gonna harm you, not while I'm around.
Composer and lyricist Stephen Sondheim was born on this date in 1930 in New York City. He studied piano and organ and at 15 wrote a musical at the George School in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. Under the tutelage of a family friend, Oscar Hammerstein II, he studied musical theater. In the early 1950s, he wrote scripts in Hollywood for the Topper television series. Returning to New York, he wrote incidental music for The Girls of Summer in 1956. He made his first mark on Broadway as the lyricist for Leonard Bernstein's West Side Story. He was also lyricist for Gypsy. A funny thing happened on the way to the Forum opened in New York City on May 8, 1962, with music and lyrics by Sondheim. It ran for 964 performances. 2 years later, his Anyone Can Whistle closed after only 9 performances. Sondheim later won Tony Awards for a number of Broadway productions of shows with his music and lyrics, including Company, Follies, A Little Night Music, and Sweeney Todd, The Demon Barber of Fleet Street. He later collaborated on the production Sunday in the Park with George, which opened on Broadway May 2, 1984, after a lengthy preparation. Sondheim's acerbic lyrics hit responsive chords with many. Most critics agree that his work marked a break from more traditional and sentimental musical comedies of the earlier decades of the century. Sondheim, a musical tribute, was staged in NYC March 11, 1973.
Not to worry, not to worry. I may not be smart, but I ain't dumb. I can do it, put me to it, show me something I can overcome. Not to worry, Mom. Being close and being clever ain't like being true. I don't need to, I will never hide a thing from you.
Roosevelt L. Thompson, a Little Rock native who was recognized as one of the most gifted people to have attended Yale University, died at 5:25 a.m. on this date in 1984 while driving on the New Jersey Turnpike during the last semester of his senior year at Yale. Newsweek later ran a one-page obituary about Thompson titled Rosie, He Was the Best of Us. The auditorium of Little Rock Central High School is now named after Thompson, and a scholarship in Thompson's name is awarded to Central students every year. A new branch of the Central Arkansas Library System named after Thompson opened at 38 Rawlings Circle in West Little Rock on September 25th, 2004. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Ithi Agnihotri Modolkar.
A few things that we thought you should know about on this Tuesday, March 22nd. Opera in the Ozarks' latest season, its 61st, will begin in June. Yesterday, Opera in the Ozarks announced its official summer 2011 season. Selections this year include Die Fledermaus, The Marriage of Figaro, and Little Women. All but three of this year's performances will be at Inspiration Point, just west of Eureka Springs. That's home of Opera in the Ozarks since its inception more than 60 years ago. Those other three performances will be indoor performances, one of each opera, at Arend Arts Center in Bentonville. Opening night is in Eureka Springs on June 24th.
The University of Arkansas has made changes to the schedule of final exams to accommodate the visit of the Dalai Lama. The 8 a.m. exam on May 11th has been moved to 7 a.m. the same day. The 10:15 a.m. and 1 p.m. exams on May 11th have been moved to the same times on May 7th. The Dalai Lama will take part in a panel discussion at 9:30 a.m. and give a keynote address at 1:30 p.m. on May 11th. The changes were made by the provost's office after requests were made by faculty and students to revise the exam schedule to help as many people as possible to attend the events.
So basically no finals during the Dalai Lama's presentations.
Yes.
All right. The University of Arkansas gymnastics team will compete in the NCAA regionals for an eighth consecutive year. Yesterday, the NCAA made the Razorbacks the number two seed at the Denver University Regional on April 2nd. And the university's women's basketball team now knows their next opponent in the WNIT. Arkansas will play Oral Roberts University in Tulsa tomorrow night. Arkansas advanced to the round of 16 in the tournament Sunday afternoon with a win over Missouri State, and ORU last night defeated Tulane to earn the right to host the Razorbacks tomorrow night. And finally, Ithi, your chance to participate in a sporting event of a different kind. Yesterday, it was announced the second annual competitive stair climb event in Little Rock will let athletes walk or climb 39 flights of stairs at the Metropolitan Tower in downtown Little Rock. That event is sponsored by the American Lung Association. You have time to train. It will be held May 14th.
That sounds tiring.
It does.
Do you like trail tours, Kyle?
Sure. I don't know if I've ever taken a trail tour, but sure.
Okay. Because Fayetteville Mayor Lionel Jordan will lead the first family trail tour of the year on April 2nd. The tour is part of Let's Move Fayetteville campaign, which is part of the nationwide campaign launched by the First Lady, Michelle Obama. The initiative hopes to tackle the issue of childhood obesity. The event begins right in front of our office. Near the Fayetteville Public Library at 11:30 a.m. on April 2nd, and we'll head to Wilson Park via the Frisco Trail.
It's Tuesday, the 22nd day of March, 2011. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is Becca Bacon-Martin. She's the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
And as we discussed yesterday, many of our listeners, or at least some of our listeners, are on spring break.
Or have children who are.
Right. Or moments when they're on spring break.
Right.
And I may sneak out and take a moment or two today.
Because?
The Jones Center is hosting some things all week.
Yeah, and they're great at spring break.
Oh. And today is AETN PBS Family Day. They're going to have the Cat in the Hat, Clifford the Big Red Dog, Sid the Science Kid, Buddy the Dinosaur, and Dog from the popular show Word World.
Great.
Plus Magic by Freddie Fusion at 10 and 2. The whole thing is free. Now, if you need tickets to the performances, here's how this works. Go early. Mm-hmm. They start selling, or they start giving them out at 8 o'clock the day of the show. Mm-hmm. So if you want to go to tomorrow's shows, which are at 10 and 2 and happen to feature, oh, my favorite band in the world, Trout Fishing in America, you should go at 8 and get your ticket.
I see.
Also today, a spring break movie at the Fayetteville Public Library. It's at 2 o'clock. It's free, and it's Toy Story 3.
Great movie.
Spring break movie at the Rogers Public Library at 2 o'clock for ages 13 and up. Girls Just Want to Have Fun.
I'm not familiar with that one.
And tonight, as part of the Arkansas Archaeological Survey
monthly
meeting, mm-hmm. Thank you, a Confederate encampment at Cross Hollow with Jerry Hilliard.
And if you've never heard Jerry Hilliard talk about history and archaeology, that means
he's
you've
fascinating.
Missed something. He is.
It starts at 7 o'clock, and it's at the Survey Building in Fayetteville. You can find out more at 575-3556.
Thank you, Becca.
Thank you, Kyle.
Becca Bacon Martin is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers. This is Ozarks at Large. The 88th General Assembly is rolling along in Little Rock. Many lawmakers continue to eye next week as the final one for the legislature this year. Last week, a major step toward ending the session took place when negotiations between House and Senate leaders led to an agreement on a tax cut package. Still to go, finding common ground on highway funding. A linchpin to Speaker of the House Robert Moore's highway funding package, an increase on diesel fuel tax in Arkansas, stalled yesterday in a Senate committee, failing to garner the 5 votes required to move on. Speaker Moore, a Democrat from Arkansas City, says he'll continue to try to get the bill through committee. Last Friday, Roby Brock, from our content partner TalkBusiness.net, sat down with the Speaker at the state capitol to talk about tax cuts and highways.
Let's talk about the tax cut deal that came together late this week. 6 bills, 3 from the House, 3 from the Senate. Pretty good compromise, about $35 million in tax cut revenue if you add it all up. Is it the deal that you had hoped for?
Well, not in the specifics, but I think the combination of the bills that ended up passing are diverse in that they pretty much touch every Arkansan out there. There's tax relief for certainly low income. There's incentive for business. There's incentive for economic development over in the most economically distressed area of the state, over in East Arkansas. We've got, I think, a good bunch of bills that the people of the state of Arkansas will appreciate. And the good thing about it came about as a result of work on both ends of the Capitol here and across the aisles. It was a Democrat, Republican, House and Senate compromise and getting together. And, of course, the governor having his strong leadership in the midst of it. But I think we ended up with a good batch of tax cut bills.
Well, we saw a lot of what was going on. You saw some display from some House members voting on some general improvement fund money. You saw them on some budget bills throughout the session. What led to the breakthrough? I mean, kind of what was the tipping point in these negotiations to cut this tax cut compromise?
Well, obviously, each House has its own strong opinions about what's best for the people of the state of Arkansas. And the way the political process worked and the bills that went out and down to the Senate, and I think, the governor had good communication with the Senate down there, and they kind of had some agreement on the bills that they thought were meritorious. And the House had some concerns about good bills that we had down there that didn't seem to be having any legs, and so we just had a lot of good talks together. And
that's so vague. You can't tell me any more about what these talks entailed. I mean,
well,
just
we were
broken, I guess.
We were advocating for some tax cuts that we felt very strongly about on the House, and after a lot of discussion on it, had agreement in the Senate and the governor that we had a couple of good House tax bills down there, 3 of them that deserve some favorable action, and lo and behold, we got it done today. At least step one today. We're moving, and I have every faith that we'll get it done.
Let's shift gears to highways, no pun intended. Obviously, you are pushing a roads program here for interstate and 4-lane highways. Right now, the diesel fuel tax increase of 5 cents is down in the Senate right now.
Right.
Bring me up to speed on where negotiations are with that and how optimistic or pessimistic you are that you can get that out of the Senate public transportation panel.
Well, I'm optimistic. I'd say I'm very optimistic because it's the right thing to do. Now, in politics somewhere, sometimes that's not the defining element as to what gets done. But from the beginning of the session, this has been a cause that I've tried to keep at the forefront in the House, and now have tried to move that momentum down to the Senate, simply because we have a funding deficiency in our highway funding stream right now that is going to have continuing negative impacts, certainly on the safety of our citizens of our state as they move about in our very mobile society, but also of paramount importance to the future of economic development in the state. Without good roads to deliver goods and services around the state, all of our other efforts for economic development are going to be substantially impaired. Certainly in the business world, it's pretty fundamental that industry staying, industry coming into a state, look at the state's the road system that are there that they'll be utilizing, and the state's ability to fund their highways. So the diesel tax proposal that will be referred to the people, of course, the people of the state ultimately get to make that decision if this is if this is the right thing to do, the right way to fund our highways. It is simply the only option that we have right now left in this session to do something to take care of this very substantial problem. There certainly is a consensus. The Trucking Association is supportive of the tax, which they'll be the primary segment of the population that will be paying the tax. They realize that if that doesn't send a strong message when an entity or an association is indicating its support to tax itself because of the dire needs to make the repairs to our highways, I don't think anything can speak any louder than that. Of course, the fact that state chambers, Association of Arkansas Counties, Municipal League, all support this proposal just gives you a pretty good grasp of the recognition of the problem and that this is the way that we have to fix it. So I'm going to assume that for whatever considerations are down there on that committee, that they're ultimately going to look at the fact that this is the right thing to do for the people of the state of Arkansas, and they're going to cast their vote accordingly.
One of the things that I think you were ambitious about at the very beginning of the session was changing the way, the formula for right. which we pay for roads, yeah. and clearly there wasn't consensus yeah. there to do something dramatically different, and so we've gone after the same tax structure that that has been used in the past, basically, yeah. in your proposal. Do you think that the formula for changing the way we fund roads can change, or is it imperative still to you that it must change? And where does that political will come from if it's not here today?
Very good question, because, yes, fundamentally, we're going to have to find a different way that we get our highway funding. Right now, it's based on a gallonage tax. We know all the reasons that consumption's going, prices go up, consumption go down. Vehicles are more efficient. People fuel efficient. People travel less. As the consumption goes down, our revenue goes down. But the cost of maintaining our highways is continuing to go up. Just the usage and certainly the heavy haulers and things that are continuing to. Impact our roadways, and so what I started out in the beginning of the session was that we should go from a gallonage tax to an excise tax so that we're as costs as you know I get choked when I talk about it because of the reaction I got, but as cost increased, we should have the ability to increase our. The funds that are available. Obviously, there was, in spite of my best effort, that didn't sell. And of course, the primary thing that I got as a pushback was just not the right time. It's not the right time for this kind of new tax. Which, of course, I countered. There is never a right time for this kind of tax. I mean, it's tough now. It's going to be tough anytime. I am concerned that. Not having found a great deal of support in there, and there definitely I had some support out there. There's no doubt. I just never was convinced that I had enough to to get it all the way through the process, and I didn't want to ask members to have that political liability of voting for a tax if I didn't think that we were going to ultimately be successful, and I didn't think that. But if the thing that really does concern me, if with the situation that we're in, the knowledge that we have regarding the deficiency in our funding and leadership really working hard to get this out to the legislature, and we weren't able to do it, I don't know when we're going to get that will. And the bad thing about it is that the will ultimately develop because the highways will get so bad, ultimately, if we don't do anything different, whether that's 10 years or 15 years, but they'll get so bad that people demand that that we make those tough decisions, find a different funding model. By then, the costs are exorbitant. The damage that's done to our economy in the future because of having poor roads is going to be long term.
Robert Moore is a Democrat from Arkansas City and Speaker of the House for the 88th General Assembly. He spoke to Roby Brock of TalkBusiness.net last Friday at the state capitol. Yesterday, the Speaker's proposal to increase the state's tax on diesel fuel to help pay for repairs to roads and highways stalled in a Senate committee. The Speaker says he'll continue to work to try to get the bill through committee. Support for content from TalkBusiness.net on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, offering the tools and services to make Arkansas businesses work. More information is available at bankozarks.com. And Verizon, offering small business solutions, including high-speed mobile broadband, wireless email, global services, and push-to-talk. More information at a Verizon communication store or online at vzw.com/small business.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Iti Agnihotri Mudholkar.
And I'm Kyle Kellums, and it's time for our question, your chance to win two tickets to see the Canadian Tenors at Walton Arts Center on Saturday, April 9th at 2 p.m.
And the giveaway question is related to the Women's History Month of March. We talked about women's status in Arkansas earlier in the show, and the question is, what famous American aviator was the first and only pilot to hold the women's altitude, solo endurance, and speed records simultaneously?
The only person to hold all three records at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And the choices are?
A. Amelia Earhart. B. Mildred Bruce. C. Louise Thaden.
Amelia Earhart, Mildred Bruce, or Louise Thaden. And you picked this question based on Arkansas women's history.
Correct.
1-800-522-5823. That's 1-800-522-5823. You have 5 minutes to call in, beginning now.
And the correct answer to today's question is, Louise Thaden was the first pilot and the only pilot to hold the women's altitude, solo endurance, and speed records simultaneously.
And Louise Thaden is a native of Arkansas, and the Bentonville Airport is the Louise Thaden Airport.
Okay.
So there you go. Local support for Ozarks at Large. Oh, I should tell you that yesterday's winner was Bob Maples. Bob knew that Siloam Springs' first name, according to the Siloam Springs website, was Hico, H-I-C-O. And Bob was listening in?
Siloam Springs?
Yes. So he had the inside track. So Bob has two tickets to the Canadian Tenors, as does today's winner.
Mm-hmm.
Local support for Ozarks at Large comes from the Prairie Grove Telephone Company, meeting the telecommunication needs of Western Washington County since 1906. Information available at pgtelco.com.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Springdale, Rogers, Peavine, Oklahoma, a listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. KUEF has proudly served as your source for NPR programming for the past 26 years. You can listen online at our website, kuaf.com.
Peavine, which is, I believe, kind of halfway between Westville and Zion in Adair County. My word for it. Okay.
Yes, okay, yeah. I will.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Iti Agnihotri Mudholkar.
Have a great Tuesday.